You're listening to The Leonard LoPate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
For thousands of years, girls from rural China have been the least valued members of the country's traditional society. But as Leslie T. Chang explains in her new book, Factory Girls, China's Industrial Revolution is allowing girls who are willing to migrate to the cities the chance to make their fortunes and to escape their prescribed roles. Ms. Chang is a first-generation Chinese-American who lived in China for 10 years while reporting for the Wall Street Journal. Her book is published by Spiegel & Grau, and I'm pleased that it brings Leslie T. Chang to the show today. Hello.
Hi.
Most media reports have painted a pretty gloomy picture of the conditions endured by Chinese migrants working in factories. Are the girls who are doing these jobs as miserable as many of us would imagine them to be?
Yeah, that was kind of my starting point, was I had been working in the Wall Street Journal in China for a number of years, and I noticed that many newspapers, including my own, had done stories about the situations in the factories, and they were generally focused on the most negative cases, the abuses, the miserable conditions, the terrible bosses. And what I was curious about was, what is migration like from the young women's point of view? What is it like to come out from the village? And what I found was that even though the conditions are very terrible, especially when they first come out, for them it's also an adventure and an opportunity and a way to kind of change the direction of their lives.
So one of the girls that you got to know well, Min, working 13-hour days, 7 days a week, that wasn't so awful as far as she was concerned?
Well, it's awful from our point of view, but, you know, if you're coming from the Chinese countryside, these conditions that we see as terrible are just kind of a given, you know. And for her, the main focus was not, my life is terrible and this is so unfair. It was, what can I do to get a slightly better job?
And they told you that they expected some suffering would be connected with Chuxia. The kind of, to go out, to leave your home?
That's right, yeah. I mean, in the past decade, migration in China has become a fairly common phenomenon in rural China. So young men and women see going out, chuqi, as you said, as kind of a rite of passage. And so they know that this is going to be a huge challenge and at the same time a huge opportunity, and they're kind of girding themselves for it as they leave.
Well, wasn't it considered shameful for a single girl from the countryside to move to the city alone just a few years ago?
Yeah, in the old days, you know, migration started basically when China's economic reforms began, kind of the early 80s. In the early days, it was definitely seen as shameful for single people and especially women to go out. You know, it was common to hear, oh, you're going to be tricked into being a prostitute and we'll never hear from you again. People were very fearful of city life. But now that's totally changed, and it's basically what's now shameful is staying home and not going out to work.
And they're not being tricked into being prostitutes?
Well, in my impression, no. I actually, in one of my chapters of the book, I spent some time talking to prostitutes who work in the karaoke clubs in this town, Dongguan, in South China, where I focused my reporting.
Well, that's the town across from Hong Kong?
That's right, yeah. It's a coastal town probably an hour's drive from Hong Kong in South China. And what was striking to me about the young women who are prostitutes, who are, again, all migrants from rural China, was that they generally came from more better-off families than the factory girls. And my conclusion from that was sort of, you know, they came to the city, and because they didn't have this incredible pressure to send money home so their younger siblings could go to school or so their family could slightly improve their house, a lot of them just kind of lost direction and just wanted to make a lot of money and buy nice clothes and live in the city.
But don't these factory girls also tend to be the brightest and best educated young people in their villages? There must be a brain drain going on.
Absolutely.
In the countryside.
Yeah, no, absolutely. That's one of the interesting things about the migration, which when you think about it is quite natural, you know, sort of like the immigration from Europe to America. You know, the most able, enterprising, resourceful people went out because they were able to and they had the guts to do it. So,
but also because they saw no opportunities for themselves back home. And that's what
right.
These girls are saying as well. They left because they had nothing to do at home.
Right, right. Yeah, that's kind of what I hope to achieve in writing this book, was to show that these young women are not downtrodden, are not victims, are not passive. They're definitely in control of their own fates. That's how they see their lives.
Well, hadn't they helped their parents with farm work when they were at home?
Not so much. You know, now with this younger generation of migrants, probably in the last decade or so, mostly what they've done before going to the city is go to school. You know, they'll go to elementary school and then middle school, probably in the town near home. And then usually after middle school, either their family won't have the money to pay for higher education, meaning high school, or they won't test into the next level of education, so they'll just go out to work.
So how old are they when they're doing this?
Generally 16 or 17 when they first go out from home.
It must be a bit scary. A kid has been in a village that is pretty much cut off from everything, and suddenly finding herself in the big city?
Definitely, yeah. I think it's very scary. And what was interesting was when I talked to migrants about their initial journey out from home, they often could not recall many important details, you know, and I had a feeling that it was so blurred and kind of traumatic because the change was so intense that they'd just sort of forgotten a lot of things.
And it said that they're part of the largest mass migration in world history. Really, there have been some pretty big migrations. For example, when India was partitioned, millions of people moved.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this migration, according to statistics of the Chinese government, is about 130 million people living and working away from home, and that number is increasing every year.
And where are they coming from, going to the southern part of China?
They're coming from all over China, mostly the interior. You know, different areas kind of send more migrants to different places. So kind of the poor interior northern provinces will send people to Beijing in the north. But, you know, a lot of the poor interior southern provinces or central will send people to Dongguan, the city that I write about.
My guest is Leslie T. Chang. Her book, Factory Girls, From Village to City in a Changing China, published by Spiegel and Grau. Are girls more likely to migrate than boys, or are they just more likely to be hired by the factories?
Both boys and girls migrate nationally. I think the number is roughly 2/3 male, 1/3 female. I focused on Dongguan because it had many, many factories, and those generally hire young women who are seen as more diligent and easier to manage than the boys. But one thing I did find was, you know, because of these still traditional ideas in rural China, that boys often had pressure to stay close to home so they could sort of be close to their parents, while girls had fewer expectations on them. And I think that was kind of a blessing in disguise because they could go further from home without their parents meddling and telling them what to do.
Well, has China's one-child policy had any noticeable impact on the number of girls available to fill these factory jobs?
Well, you know, the one-child policy is actually very complicated. In the cities, basically all families have one child, but in the countryside, it's been implemented in a huge, you know, a spectrum of different ways. And so among the migrants that I met, not a single one was an only child, and many were not even born, had even more than one sibling.
Although, since girls are not valued as highly as boys, were parents more likely to allow their daughters to migrate than a son?
In my experience, the parents at this point don't have that much say, you know, and the young people are going out because their friends are going out, their older brothers and sisters are going out. So it's not really like the kids want to go and the parents don't, or the parents want them to go and the kids don't. It's sort of seen as a natural rite of passage.
Well, what about marriage? Haven't marriage prospects improved for girls now that males outnumber females by a continually growing margin?
Yeah, that figure, I think, is, you know, it's pretty complicated, again, like most statistics in China. That figure is the birth rate, you know, this many boys, 114 boys for every 100 girls born. But my sense is that a lot of the numbers don't capture the realities in China, and many girls are being born and not being registered, but maybe a few years later they'll be registered. And migration is further complicating these statistics because the person's home village is supposed to keep track of all their numbers, but once they move to the city, they kind of disappear off the radar.
Once they move to the city, do they stay there permanently, or do they tend to go back to their homes?
That's changing too. In the past, people would generally go out to work for a few years and then go home to the village and farm, marry and farm. But now more and more young couples are getting married to, you know, with other migrants and settling down in the city. So that's kind of the expectation now, is to hopefully settle down in the city rather than to return to the farm.
In the past, their parents would have expected them to marry somebody they had chosen. And now that's not happening anymore?
Parents still want their child to marry someone from a nearby village. It's really interesting because these migrants go to these factories where they suddenly meet people from all over China. And most likely they'll start dating someone who comes from another province. And their parents don't understand this. And, you know, one of the young women I write about, Min, She's from Hubei province, and her parents insisted that she date someone not only from Hubei province, but from their part of Hubei province. And, you know, I don't think in the big city Min ever met anyone who fit that description, so it was impossible for her to fulfill her parents' expectations.
Are they all looking to get married?
It depends. I mean, they're...
Because they're suddenly experiencing this new kind of
exactly.
independence that you describe
yeah.
here, and I would think that the independence not only would be from their families, but perhaps from the pressures to get married.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think many young women who come out are determined not to get married early because they want to have some achievements first. And then they feel like once they have these achievements, they move into a different class and the person they marry will be of a higher class. So they're very concerned with sort of having something to show for their time in the city very soon after they arrive.
Well, we mentioned that you focus on the stories of two migrants that you met in Dongguan. One Min, who's 16 years old, but the other one, Chun Ming, is 30 years old. Is she unmarried?
She is still unmarried, yeah. She's probably about 35 now. It's been about 5 years since I first met her. I was curious to get to know what life was like for an older woman in the city. And in a city like Dongguan, where there's so many young workers, older means someone, you know, over the age of 30. And she had been in the city about a decade when I met her. And she was one of these who was very concerned with not getting married early on. It's really interesting. She showed me her diaries, and there are all these letters to her parents, and she says, I will definitely not marry at this time. And you can tell she's getting a lot of pressure. But, you know, now she's sort of risen off the assembly line into sort of white-collar sales work, and she's finding it very hard to find a husband who suits her, you know. So it's a very complicated thing. They have a lot of freedom, but it's also full of conflicts and regrets of what they haven't done.
Because in she probably earns more than a lot of the men she would meet.
Yeah, yeah. It's sort of like a middle class, you know, urban America problem, right? They can't find the person who exactly suits them anymore.
Yeah. But what happens to these women? Okay, they arrive at 16, and as you point out, they have no hesitation jumping from one job to another. Sometimes they only stay in a new job for a few weeks as they're moving up the ladder. But at a certain point, don't they hit a ceiling?
It depends. I mean, the ones who are more ambitious and aggressive will basically move up out of factory, not the factory world, but the factory floor. And it's actually a lot easier for women to move up than men because women are seen as also better for doing sales jobs, clerk jobs, secretarial jobs, the jobs that are sort of at the lowest level of the office world. So it's quite common to see young women move up after a year or two. You know, they might take an English class or computer class and then present themselves as an educated person for this new job. But
also study Cantonese, because even though Mandarin is the language of China, Cantonese is the language of this area here where mm-hmm. so much of the business is done in Hong Kong as well.
Yeah, that was actually one of the many interesting things I found in Dongguan was that things change really quickly. And for Chun Ming, the older migrant I wrote about in her early days, Cantonese was the language of the factories. But now, because there's so many migrants from all over China and also the investment pool has increased, that people speak Mandarin, the official dialect, to each other. So that's one of the many things that have changed in Dongguan over the past decade.
My guest is Leslie T. Chang. Her book, Factory Girls, From Village to City in a Changing China, published by Spiegel & Grau. We will continue our conversation after this. My guest is Leslie T. Chang, who lived in China for a decade as a correspondent for the Wall Street Journal. She's written a book called Factory Girls, From Village to City in a Changing China, published by Spiegel & Grau. Isn't there an actor named Leslie Chang?
Yes, he was a Hong Kong pop singer actor who was in many of Wong Kar-wai's best movies.
Uh-huh. People ever confuse you when they look at your name?
Well, I get a lot of letters addressed to Mr. Leslie Chang, and sometimes even after I've already met the person, which is kind of strange, but there you go.
We talked about how these girls just keep on moving from job to job. Didn't you find it difficult to keep in touch with some of the ones you wanted to include in the book because of that?
Yeah, that was actually my biggest challenge and one of the biggest surprises of reporting the factory world. You know, I thought it would be hard to get to know young women and get them to talk to me because they didn't know who I was. In fact, that was the easy part, to just meet girls on the street and talk to them and take them to a coffee shop and talk for an hour. That was easy. The hard part was keeping in touch with them from week to week. You know, they would give me a phone number, and then I'd call it a week later, and it would be out of service, or the girl would have already left, and then she was lost to me forever. You know, it was really sort of frustrating and terrifying.
You gave men a mobile phone, but it was stolen.
I did, yeah. I gave her a mobile phone because I had gotten to know her over a couple of meetings, and I really liked her, and I thought she was really talkative and enterprising and interesting. And I was desperate not to lose touch with her. And over the next few months, I got to know her older sister and her cousin and some other people, and I was certain to – I got the first thing I would do was get all their mobile phone numbers. So when Min's mobile phone was stolen, it was her cousin who called me up and told me, you know, this is her new number, this is where she is.
Nobody cares about their employment record. In this country, if I applied for a job – and they saw that I'd kept one job 3 weeks, another one 2 months, another one 4 months, another one 3 days, they would think that I was not the kind of person they'd want to hire.
Mm-hmm. Well, they just lie about it, and that's sort of seen as a very, you know, everyone lies in this world. I mean, the casual dishonesty and corruption of that world is just amazing.
And why would they leave jobs so quickly? Because they don't get paid, or because the hours turn out to be even worse than they imagined?
Yeah, all those reasons. Just it's not as good a job as they could get. I mean, basically, when they first come out to the city, the first job they land usually has terrible conditions because they don't know the situation very well and they're desperate just to have a paycheck and a place to sleep. But then once they're in the factory, they immediately start hearing all this gossip and intelligence about what are the better factories, so they immediately want to jump to a better factory.
Because they're enduring 13-hour days, eating bad food, sharing a dorm room with 11 other girls.
Yeah, or possibly much worse. I mean, and one of the worst things is many of these jobs, they never, ever have a day off, you know, or the last day they had off was 2 months ago.
Sometimes it's forced overtime as well. If they have to turn something out under a deadline,
they just keep
on working until they drop.
Yeah, yeah, especially, and, you know, this is tied to the global, you know, our shopping cycles in America. You know, in the 2 months leading up to Christmas, their hours would get longer and longer, and some of the factories, they'd work all night.
At one point, you accompanied Min to Duongguan's talent market while she searched for a new job. Can you tell us about that place?
Yeah, the talent market was kind of an amazing place. Those actually only came up in the last few years. It's kind of like a giant job fair where there are thousands of jobs on offer. And, you know, what you referred to, these young people casually lying about their experience, I mean, that was sort of how the talent market operated. You know, you would sit down at a booth and say, I want this job, and then the person would ask you what your experience was. And, you know, in Min's case, she had worked in human resources at her factory for 26 days, and she went to the talent market and told them that she had worked there for a year, and she got hired.
And they hire you on the spot. But why do so many companies enforce a height requirement in hiring new employees?
Well, I think that's one of the odd things about China. You know, there's sort of an obsession with height, and that often has nothing to do with the job. You'd see all these ads that are like, you know, a teacher or a secretary has to be a certain height, you know, someone, a receptionist. You know, I think
they want tall.
They
Not
want
sure.
tall. Yeah, they want tall. A woman should be at least 160 centimeters, which is about 5 feet, and which doesn't sound very high, but, you know, people in China, especially from rural China, are often quite a bit smaller. And, you know, I think it says something to China's recent past. You know, this is a country that until a few years ago, people did not get enough nutrition, and height was a sign of good background and breeding and a class, basically.
So wealthier people literally look down on the poor.
That's right. Yeah. Wealthier people, the people in the cities are taller. And when you hang around the construction sites of the big cities like Beijing and you see the migrant workers, they're all tiny. You know, they're shorter than I am, the men.
Some positions were open only to candidates from families with more than one child. Why?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, the employers generally felt that having siblings made a person more flexible, better, easier to get along with other people. And, you know, there's probably some merit in that.
And better able to, in the English translation, eat bitterness.
Yes, chikku. That was kind of the most common phrase you saw on help wanted ads was 愿意吃苦耐劳, willing to eat bitterness and work hard. That was the main requirement for most jobs in Duongguan.
You're right about trying to get to know girls at Duongguan's Yuyuan factory. Is that how it's pronounced?
Yes, the Yuyuan shoe factory.
They manufacture running shoes. And they have 70,000 people working there?
Yeah, that was an amazing
world. That's a small city.
Yeah, it's not even, it's a mid-sized city. You know, I looked at the American populations. It's roughly the, as if everyone in Santa Fe was making shoes full-time, man, woman, and child.
And then they have their own kindergarten, a hospital, movie theater, power plant, even a fire department.
Yeah, it was an amazing world. And what was interesting about that was many of the young women who worked there spent all their time on the factory compound, even though they could come and go at will, and there was no curfew or no, you know, reason to stay in. But many of them felt that the city outside was dangerous, and they would prefer to stay inside the factory all the time.
And this was a preferred place to work because they actually paid people on time?
This was seen as a very stable, solid place to work. The salary was reliable. It was clear how much you would be making every month, and the conditions were seen as pretty good, which is they got every Sunday off, and they only worked up to, you know, 14 hours in really tough times. So that kind of gives you your baseline of what conditions are like.
My guest is Leslie T. Chang, whose book Factory Girls from Village to City in a Changing China is published by Spiegel and Grau. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. The woman you wrote about, who's 30 years old, Chen Ming, had been working since she, in the big city since she was 14 years old. I mean, 16 years old, so about 14 years or so.
That's right. Yeah, she lived in Dongguan for more than a decade by the time I met her.
And she seems really entrepreneurial and self-assured and driven to succeed.
Yeah. That's one of the things I liked about her was she was incredibly she was full of confidence and optimism about her situation, even though she had a lot of very dicey things happen to her. And, you know, one thing I thought was really interesting about her was how many weird ideas she'd taken from America, but often in very convoluted and distorted ways.
She read inspirational books about Ben Franklin and Lee Iacocca's book.
Yeah, and she would always tell me these things like, Ben Franklin, you know, the one who invented the light bulb, you know, he was a vegetarian, and did you know that? And I said, no, I didn't know that. And she'd be telling me all these facts about Ben Franklin. I had no idea what she was telling me about.
But she came into a bit of money participating in a pyramid scheme. Later, she gets a job where she can skim.
Yeah, that's the direct sales / pyramid schemes were very common in China in the late 90s, especially in South China. And again, this was kind of a sort of bizarre import from America, you know, where companies like Amway and Avon have built their networks on these networks of salespeople. So this was growing very fast in China, but often very dicey, weird scams, you know, people just being asked to pay, you know, more than $100 for a box of medicine, and then they would have to recruit 50 people to spend the same amount of money. And Chun Ming got into several of these schemes. She just loved the idea of being able to set up your network and then just sit back and watch the money flow in, and she's never gotten over that obsession, I think.
And where does the money go? Do they send it back to their families?
Yeah, initially they send, you know, it depends on the person, but many of the young women I met when they first came out from home would send almost all their earnings back home. You know, Min, the younger woman I met, would basically keep, you know, $20, the equivalent of $20 for her own expenses for the month and send everything else home. But the longer they stay in the city, the more they come to feel that their own lives and their own interests must be protected. And often they would set up bank accounts, not tell their parents, or their parents would object, but they do it anyway, to kind of look out for their own futures.
And they tend not to go home as often as I would have imagined. I thought that there was a tradition of returning home every Chinese New Year.
Yeah, many migrants still do that, but it was interesting how for many of them the return home was a choice, you know, and you know, Min in her first couple years out from home did not return home once because she wanted to wait until her job was something she could be proud of and she had saved up some money before she went home.
You went home with her.
I did,
after
yes.
After a couple of years in the big city.
Yeah, I went back with her to her village for the Chinese New Year, 2 weeks in a two-room farmhouse with no plumbing and heating. It was quite an experience.
So you understood why she would have wanted to have left. Is what she left the sort of thing that we would have thought about as being the norm during the Mao years?
That
kind of communal
farm? I think conditions have changed some since the Mao years. No, it's now back to kind of individual family farms. But in terms of living standards, it's still obviously way, way backward compared to the city. So one of the interesting things was after spending 2 weeks in the village with Min, we took the train together back to the city. And when we got to the city, which is like this big, sprawling, chaotic, polluted city, Min and I were both like, we're back, you know? So I felt like I understood at that moment more than any other moment exactly what the city meant to her.
Well, what does Min say to her parents about the conditions they live in? Because she has seen alternative styles.
Yeah, she was very critical. That was one of the things that surprised me. I thought when she went back to the village, she would kind of fall back into her traditional role. She was a second child of five, you know, Confucian respect for parents. And no, it wasn't that way at all. You know, she immediately got home and she said, you know, you need to stop throwing out garbage on the floor. You need to stop using these cups. They're dirty. You need to close the window. You know, she was trying to basically reform and civilize her family. You know, it's very
interesting. And how did they react? Were they shocked that she was criticizing them? After all, as you said, that wasn't in the past, that would have been unheard of.
Right. No, I mean, that was sort of the poignant thing, was her parents sort of just took it, you know? They didn't lecture her. They didn't tell her she should behave this way or that. It was kind of an acknowledgement that she was right and that she had already learned more about the world than they knew.
And you report that she became even less respectful of her parents after she got a higher-paying job in a factory's purchasing department, supplementing her income with kickbacks.
Mm-hmm.
Did she send greater sums of money back home? Was that part of the deal?
There's no deal, but yeah, she sent home a huge amount of money home. And in fact, I talked with her about a month ago, and she has purchased an apartment for her parents in the city near their village. So because of her, her parents are leaving farming to become urban dwellers, you know, amazingly, in the course of her 3 years of working in the city.
You've included your own family's history in this book, although it's very different from that of the migrant workers. When your family was in China, could any of this have occurred?
Well, that's what made me want to write my family story. My father's father had actually gone out to Chuqiu from a rural village in northeastern China. And his path was different. You know, he was going to college in Beijing, and then he went to came to America to study and then moved back to China for work. But what I found interesting was how he saw this enterprise of leaving home and building a new life versus how the migrants I met saw it. And for him, it was all about nation and country and helping China develop. There was no sense in his diaries, which I read at length, about himself, about his own future or his own hopes. It was all subsumed to the nation. And what was really striking about these young women was how they were so focused on their own lives, crafting their own identities and personas. And I feel like that's kind of a very new thing for China, the sense of developing the individual.
Well, that's something that the government has told them it really wants them to do. We've seen an amazing change in philosophy in China, haven't we?
That's true.
If you had an entrepreneurial spirit, you could wind up in jail. Now we encourage you to have an entrepreneurial spirit.
Yeah, it's kind of amazing. Everything has completely turned upside down over the past 25 years.
And many people in the West thought that was going to lead to more democratization. But mm-hmm. How has the Chinese government created this odd balance between encouraging this sort of thing and at the same time discouraging mm-hmm. what we might see as a natural outcome of it?
Well, I think the key thing is that economic opportunity is now available to people at all levels of the social spectrum. From the urban point of view, people will say, well, people in the village are still poor. But, you know, as with Min's parents, the point is their lives are dramatically better than they were 10 years ago, 20 years ago. So these people, the poorest, are generally also profiting from the economic opening up. So I think that they're less likely right now to focus on these big issues of justice and voting. You know, all they want to do is sort of improve their lives and their situations. It's a very pragmatic focus right now in China.
I just read in the newspaper the other day that a new policy allows people on communal farms to sell the land, which suggests that there'll be more of a migration. So is China still going to be able to maintain its agricultural base?
Yeah, that's you know, a very touchy issue because communal land in China has long been one of the mainstays of the Communist Party, communal land ownership. But the reality is people are leaving the countryside in droves. And right now, the older people are still farming the land. But in the next generation, there's not going to be enough people farming these many, many plots of land. So I think you're going to see consolidation into larger commercial farms as eventually developed in the United States.
You write in the book about your grandfather being assassinated in China after World War II. Why was he killed?
He was an official for the Kuomintang, which was the official government of China at the time.
Chiang Kai-shek's
That's
government.
Right. And he was sent into northeast China to take back some of the mines from Japanese control during the war back into government hands. And he was shot and killed with bayonets in a small railroad town outside the mine where he was sent.
Because he was on the wrong side of the communist revolution?
Yeah, most likely it was seen as something the communists did as a warning to the nationalist government to stay out of this part of China and kind of like, you know, and when you look at it in the larger scale, it seemed like one of the first, you know, shots of the communist revolution and sort of these attacks against some of the most talented, promising people in China, basically.
How much had you known about your family's history before you went there and investigated it?
I'd known very basic outlines. You know, that was one of the things that I write about in the book is how little sort of traditional Chinese people, including members of my family, are like to talk about their own personal stories and sufferings. You know, that was, again, a big difference with the migrants. So it was very difficult to find all the missing pieces of my family story, and I probably missed a few, but it was very interesting to see these parallels between then and now.
You're married to Peter Hessler, who's been a guest on the show. What was he doing while you were doing all of this?
He was off doing his own thing. He's actually just finished writing his third book, which should be out next year, also about China, different aspects of how the automobile is changing lives in different parts of China.
Leslie T. Chang's book, Factory Girls, From Village to City in a Changing China, is published by Spiegel & Grau. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you very much.